welcome to Worlds Apart. For decades now, Western politics has been built around the mantra that perception is reality, that mining of emotional wedge issues increases the chances of electoral victory, and that this is indeed the democratic process and the way to make the world a better place. Is it? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Bernard Hommel, a psychology professor at Shandong Normal University in China. Professor Hommel, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thanks for your interest.
Now, I know that you have written extensively about the psychology of polarization and why society is unable to translate disagreements into new perspectives or effective solutions to its problems. To start us off, let me first ask you whether you think that polarization is a natural social phenomenon, or do you think it's more specific to the West and how political and public life in the West is currently structured?
No, I mean, the very basic of it is deep down in our hardware, in a sense. So we are dramatically in-group, out-group people. Now, this is jargon, but basically what it means is that you cannot really feel united to the entire world. That's at least not on an everyday basis. You're maybe attached to your family, and the group sizes may differ, but we all have our limits. So the critical group size, as Jonah Friedman would have it, is limited, and you may, let's say, work on this. You may expand the group size, and you may try to be not so super unfriendly to other, let's say, to the out group. But there's very interesting research in the 1960s in Israel showing that if you enter a classroom, you give 10 boys a red cap and the others a green one. Then within 1 hour, they shout at each other, they try to steal from each other, and so forth and so on. So that's very normal. That doesn't mean that it's good and easy to deal with it, but it's normal. But you can, let's say, boost this, or you can downplay. And that is, I think, what we can talk about.
Well, I think it may go even deeper down than in-group, out-group distinction, because I approach it from the Jungian perspective. And when it comes to the Jungian theory, binarity or duality is the very basic quality of consciousness. It's not a feature of the outside world, but rather consciousness or psyche learns about the environment and adapts to the environment by splitting any phenomenon into opposites and first moving to a more or like comfortable or easier side of the spectrum, and then perhaps exploring the rest of it, what the Jungians are calling the integration of the shadow. But in this frame of mind, polarization would serve necessary functional purpose, developmental purpose, but you have to sooner or later, you know, come to a point when you want to accept that things that you dislike in the others also reside in you. And there seems to be a big problem when it comes to this in political life these days. Don't you think so?
Yes, sure. I mean, our hardware has been developed hundreds of thousands of years ago for very different purposes, and certainly not for the societies we are currently having. So you would typically not meet many outgroups in your life during that time. So the problem would have been very, very small if existing at all. But the globalization, I mean, now you open the internet and then you can always meet almost everyone in the entire world. And that is, of course, opening many, many problems, creating many problems with this attitude. So we have to deal with that. There is no way around it. But there are also strong cultural differences. So, for instance, there is especially the Chinese, where I'm currently working in China. And so I also have to learn something about this culture, which is not familiar to, or has not been familiar to me before. And there's interesting research like that if you, let's say, provide conflicting information to U.S. American students versus Chinese students, you can easily find that both are realizing the contradictions within the information. So they are intellectually comparable. But the Americans are very excited and not in a good way about it, whereas the Chinese think, okay, So it's a contradiction. What do I care? Mm-hmm. So there are obviously cultural differences in the way we deal with it, and we are excited by contradictions, and that is also an interesting way to deal with these things.
Well, speaking about these cultural differences and cultural influence as well, I mentioned in my introduction the saying that perception is reality, and it's been in use for roughly 40 years, owning its origin to Lee Atwater, who was a political consultant and strategist for Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, and who was among the first to use brazen emotional manipulation openly to discredit political opponents. So he was very successful at that because he helped Reagan and Bush the senior to win those elections. Why do you think this tactic of emotionally driven discourse seems to be catching up so much in the West? Because, I mean, sure, it exists in other parts of the world as well, but I think particularly in the West, this way of discrediting your opponent seems to be prevalent, and it wasn't always like that.
I would distinguish two things. So one is, why is that an interesting, why does it work so well, you might say? And that has to do with the way our brain is structured. So we have, let's say, relatively complicated but very smart route. So we have input. Let's say the very early processing stages in our brain is processing that more and more, and it elaborates that and gets it in touch with memory so that we really have a meaningful interpretation of things. But that takes a lot of time. So we are talking still in the order of seconds, but this is for brain, let's say, processes. This is very slow. And there is a much faster route that goes straight to areas that are dedicated to emotional processing. So in other words, emotions so do not need inferences, as some researchers have said. So it goes so fast and straight to your heart, in a sense, so to the areas and the body parts that are really making you excited, that this is happening long before your rational thinking sets in. And so, okay, so this is why it works so well. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to control it, to avoid it and so forth, rather than, well, you can look away, but that's about it. Why is that? Well, because if you're, let's say, walking in the woods and you see a snake, and you are running already before you even realize that it was a snake, then you understand that this is very smart in particular context.
Well, but Professor Hommel, that's exactly my point. In particular context, when you deal with immediate survival and existential threat, that's helpful. But in politics, supposedly, especially in democratic politics, we want to stimulate not only, those emotional triggers, traumatic emotional triggers that we inherited from the past, but also a reasoned way of not just venting frustration, but actually changing, environment around us in a productive way, don't we?
Yes. Perhaps allow me two comments that are somewhat different. One is, why does it, is it so broadly used? And that is, I think, has to do more with the development of the press. So the press is based on clicks. And the clicks are much easier to get with emotions. You can go with that, you can count it, and then you can see it immediately. So make your message emotional, you get more clicks. Now, you're paid by clicks. You personally, I don't know, but many journalists are, and that makes it very rational for them to use irrational information. The other aspect is, you say, I understand what you're saying, but I think the implication is I would not share it. Mm-hmm. And the Niklas Luhmann, a very smart German sociologist, made this distinction very clear. Politics has as the currency, has power. It is about power. Science is about truth. Now, if you start saying that politics should be more rational, then you somehow imply that politics can be about truth, and I think it isn't.
Well, I think both politics and science ultimately should operate on integrity, simply because, I mean, our own psyches, we use it both for politics, we use it for science, we use it for bringing our children. So the way you enact yourself in one area of life You cannot pretend that it's somehow different in another area of life, but this is just my personal comment. Let me ask you something about you said before. I heard you say that it's only in the humanities that people can afford to have this big mouth and pay no personal consequence for, you know, expanding on the most outrageous ideas for clicks or for other benefits. But there are definitely social costs to that kind of discourse, aren't they? Because I think the rise of in mental health issues is also one correlate to that, isn't it?
It's dramatic. That's what my last book, which is only available in German, sorry for that, but I... because these things are so specific to particular countries. But what is broadly observed is that the mental health problems are rising constantly. And this is not just through the pandemics. This didn't help. Yes, that is true. But it was starting already 40 years, 50 years ago, and it's consistently increasing. The way you can tell differs a little bit between cultures. So in Western countries, is it a bit like more acting? You find more acting out, like narcissism or aggression or things like that. In China, you see more acting inside. So people do they cut themselves, or they let's say direct aggression towards themselves. That has to do with the societal upbringing and so forth and so on. So the way you can see it differs, but the problem, and that is directly, I would argue, directly related to the emotionality of our communication. The more emotional it is, and the more you unlearn coping strategies. Like a few years ago, we had cool man, right? So we had Clint Eastwood, and things like that. That's no longer fashionable. But these guys, being like this is a fantastic way to be resilient and to deal with emotionality. But that's no longer fashionable. Mm-hmm. Now you're empathetic. You have to feel with others and so forth. And that is, of course, increasing the problem rather than dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Professor Hommel, we have to be resilient for a little while because we have to take a very short break right now. But we will be back and to some extent, perhaps also emotional in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Bernard Hommel, a psychology professor at Shandong Normal University in China. Professor Hommel, just before the break, we got into the emotional regulation issues and the change in fashion that has occurred over the last couple of decades, from almost total suppression of emotions to the emotional flooding that we see all around us. But there should be some sort of mature, educated middle when you can stand in the presence of your emotions, get the information that they are providing from you, but at the same time not to be overwhelmed and allow your ego to still be the decisive actor on the scene. Why do you think it's so difficult to get to that sort of middle ground when both emotions and, you know, sound mind are present and collaborating rather than being at each other's throats?
That depends a little bit on the factor that you're currently dealing with, and to make it a bit more complicated, if you say there is health issues, then the interesting observation is that neuroticism is part of almost all the really really rising issues. Now, what is that? Well, first, I think it relies on three factors. Number one, I already mentioned the input part. So we are very sensitive to emotional information, especially pictures. So especially in let's say more in war reports, you typically see personal fate. Mothers who are crying about their babies and so forth and so on, because this is going straight to your heart. Now, how can we deal with that? Well, we can switch off. We could have a more, let's say, a more facts-based and not so much individual fate-based interpretation, which I think is compatible with good journalism. Good journalism is about facts, I thought. This is no longer the case always. Second, you can deal with many things with coping strategies. Now, there are several ways, so you already mentioned some, namely rationalization, that works pretty well. So if you, let's say, look at the same pictures, but you realize, let's say, you concentrate on the facts rather than on what they do to you, that works much better. Being cool, trying to focus on rational thinking helps quite a bit, but the problem here is it's not very fashionable anymore. Mm-hmm. All these coping strategies are no longer hot, and you defending them is you have a hard time doing that.
Perhaps this acting like an emotional child, or you know, an entitled, very passionate individual, actually, you know, earns you points. Isn't that also a fast track to recognition, to, you know, getting more visibility, as you said, and having very little in the way of having to prove your point? Essentially, it's a moral hazard created by the, you know, by the social space, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, if you have good arguments and we are having a discussion and we disagree, then let's say making things emotional is a very old, I mean, almost Greek philosophy trick to get you out of the way. Of course, it's very easy. If I, let's say you can watch political talk shows every day, and whenever things are getting serious, then someone starts with saying, yeah, but don't you think of the people and their suffering? And then what can you do? However rational your argument is, you are coming across as cold-hearted, as a mean person, and so forth and so on. So it let's say it's good for the reputation to be soft, to be nice, to be, let's say, empathetic, and so forth and so on, irrespective of the facts that you are addressing this.
Yeah, but I mean, on the flip side of this, it not only forestalls any reasoned, mature discussion that can actually lead to the practical improvement of life, but I think it also essentially legitimizes low-level psychosis and the inducement of that into the public sphere. Because if it's all about, you know, emotionality, raw emotionality, then we can never get anything's done.
Oh, of course. I mean, I'm the last one to defend this, especially because of this relatively direct link to neuroticism and mental health issues that are related to that. I'm talking about fashion. I mean, mm-hmm. Fashion can change. That's the good news. But we all have to work on this, and we have to, let's say, criticize and reflect on the consequences of something that comes across as very nice. And that is the problem. If you are, let's say, defending something that comes across as cruel, then of course it's easy to undo this. But if it comes like, oh no, we have to be open, and empathy mm-hmm. is considered to be the key to many world problems, which I think is absolutely not true. If my surgeon is feeling the pain that I feel, he's not doing a good job. He should focus on the facts and do his thing. So that's very tough. But the other aspect is our emphasis of authenticity. And this is, of course, then the idea is this is almost a cult. And it basically means that you cannot argue with someone who has more experience about this. About women, we cannot talk because you have necessarily more experience than I have. Therefore, I have to shut my mouth. And that is the way the discussions work today.
Well, that's the way the discussions work today in primarily Western political environment. Thankfully, there are some other islands of freedom that subscribe to different rules of the debate. Now, you're getting us to something that I think is very important, and this is essentially understanding why our psyches have emotionality and why and in which areas we can benefit from our sound mind. And in my personal opinion, I think emotionality is extremely helpful when you deal with differentiation in your own personal world or, let's say, family dynamics. It's extremely helpful there. But when we deal with collective issues and human behavior on a mass scale, then we have, a lot of objective data that we don't actually need, emotional or democratic input from, because just as you said, we don't need people to vouch on how the subway system should be run, because it could ultimately be dangerous. But it gets us to a question about what do you think makes certain issues into a political issues when they become overly emotional, and what is being relegated to policies? Because ultimately, I mean, much of the governance these days is highly specialized. It requires a lot of professional knowledge, a lot of deep down analysis that is not accessible to ordinary people, not because they're stupid, but simply because they don't have time and resource and scale to develop that kind of expertise. So where do you think that dividing line lies between political hot potatoes and substantive policy issues?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm able to address all the implications of what you are saying, which is a very rich issue. But we are just back from Singapore, and this is a very interesting lesson, because you may wonder, how on earth can they be so quickly, so successful, starting with 10 really bad years after their independence, and now they are one of the richest countries in the world? But the one key is indeed technocratic approaches. So they're trying to take out the ideology of most of the discussions, and apparently they succeed in this. I don't know enough to understand why and how they do this, but apparently people are cool with this if the solutions are functional, and that should be the case. But the problem I think is, it's hard to say why that is, but it is very clear that moral issues are dominating the political decision making in many countries, and that is very hard to argue against, because that makes you immoral or not interested in morality, and that of course cannot be a good person. But it stands in the way of a rational discussion, because moral issues are certainly have a reality, but they are invented. People, there is no universal moral approach. It is just different cultures do not do particular things and do not like particular things. So rationale speaking, this makes no sense. But it is very hard to tackle, mm-hmm. Because you cannot find a good argument in real life to discount that.
Well, I think we may find some explanatory ideas in the psychology of narcissism, because I think one of the distinctive features of the narcissistic psyche is that it cannot bear to be bad, or it cannot bear to be on the wrong side, even though that's, part of life. We never arrive at anything, any sound theory or any, good policy without making mistakes. But for a narcissistic psyche, they always have to be like on the winning side, like of either a debate or, let's say, a good side of history. And that seems to be like not only exploitative, but also hijacking a discourse at a point where, it's all about being good or bad rather than actually looking substantively at what we are dealing with.
That's certainly true, but let's face it. So if you look into the US, I do not know really European studies on this, but in the US they ask or they investigate the narcissistic tendencies in people for many, many years already. And when 60, 70 years ago, we were talking about, 10%, of the population that would be count as narcissistic, saying things like, I'm a really important person that one should consider, and so forth and so on. Now we are approaching 80%. Now, if that is true, then we can no longer say, this is due to a few ill, absurd people. No, it's about all of us, at least in some societies. And then the question is, what does that mean and where does it come from? Do they all get ill mentally ill, that's very unlikely. So there must be other reasons. And I think one problem is the democratic, let's say, availability of information. And that looks like everyone can become an expert overnight. You just Google, Dr. Google, and then you start arguing with your medical doctor. Right? You would never have done that 50 years ago. You would look up to the guy and say, yes, of course, I will be swallowing that pill. And now you start arguing and saying, is that really true? Why? Well, it's not that I really have expertise, but the availability of information makes me think that I'm an expert. And that is what breathes out of all these internet communications.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's not only availability of information, but also the sort of promoted style of engagement, because I recently came from a parent-teacher meeting at my school, and a teacher for my kids said that like 80% of her time now is spent on talking back to the student instead of just doing the assignment. They always start with, you know, deliberating the process and raising their emotional concerns rather than just solving a mathematical problem. But I think that leads us also to an important point, because narcissism isn't necessarily an illness. It's also a psychological developmental stage. And one feature of a mature psyche is the ability to, you know, hold ambiguity, to hold a space for a paradox, to accept that, you know, there are certain good and bad things within me, which ultimately allows a room for reflection, doesn't it?
Yes. And that would give us hope, but I'm not sure how much, because it looks like we could work on this. But then there's Dunning-Kruger. And these are two Americans. I don't know whether you heard of this famous study. And it is basically showing that, let's say, self-confidence and trust in your own judgment is negatively correlated with intelligence. So in other words, and not just intelligence in a kind of genetic way, but also knowledge. So in other words, the less I know, the more I believe that I'm right. And that's not healthy for a society, but it pre-structures the discussions because you cannot solve things if everyone believes that she's an expert.
Well, Professor Hommel, it seems like any political discussion, even if it's on psychology, is doomed to begin and end with the Americans. There is just no way around them. Anyway, this is all we have time for. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for your time.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you next week on Worlds Apart.